two talks were called Brain Imaging. It's sort of a, I was actually planning to talk more and during the first talk about a way to, a very general way to look at data sets and find new parameterization as the gymnastic is going to be able to stretch myself so I can tie this to the brilliant lectures we had yesterday. So the second talk will really be about brain imaging and how we can apply those techniques that we'll describe during the first talk to a sort of a problem that is emerging today in looking at function in people's brains. So the rough outline will be like this. I will start with an introduction, and so it's rather obvious that the pace at which we're collecting data is much faster than the pace at which we have algorithms to analyze this data. I will focus mostly in biology and specifically, in fact, in medicine. The tools that we would like to have should first to be able to understand within a data set where is the signal of interest. And we'll see, for instance, when we look at functional MRI, is that it's really buried. It's very hard to find it. It really has a complicated structure. The data that we're, at least that I will be presenting, are highly corrupted by noise. So we have changes in the signals that are absolutely non-interesting. And we're typically manipulating today gigabytes of data. I mean, we fill up disk extremely fast. So this is, we need fast algorithms. So how is that related to random shape? So first, let's look at a couple of prototype examples. So the first one is neuroimaging. Every other day, you open the New York Times, you see yet another application of functional MRI for marketing, for justice, for whatever. So there's this dogma that the brain is parcelized into regions, each of which should be responsible for a specific function. And the goal of many psychology departments in this country is sort of to identify that region of the brain that is responsible for a given task, a given cognitive process, a given sensory process. So far, the experiments have been trivial. You have someone sitting in an MRI machine, and he or she listens to some music, looks at faces, and you record images, and you see if, as you present the stimulus, you see changes in the signal. However, people have recently tried to do more sort of challenging experiments. For instance, Jim Haxby at Princeton had the following experiment. Someone watches for 1 hour a movie inside the mammoth. So what do you do there? The analysis is completely, there's no way to sort of try to explain. There are tons of stimulus, okay? There are auditory, there are lots of many different outcome that can create changes in the brain function. So we need new ways to understand how to analyze these data sets. So for instance, in the example of the movie, we have about 1,000 time samples, each of which coming from about 200,000 voxels. So we're in super high dimension. Just touching the data in MATLAB blows up my head. There's no way you can do anything if you're not clever and creative about analyzing those data. Another example, which again I will illustrate this morning, is the idea of being able to predict seizure by analyzing the electroencephalogram, so the electric recordings that you can acquire by laying electrodes on the surface of the scalp. During a seizure associated with for an epileptic patient, there are obvious time frequency changes. However, many patients have aura that precede seizures, and so the holy grail of this field is to be able to predict the seizure at least several minutes in advance. So right now, the best existing technique rely on some computation of typically one scalar number, assuming that the brain behaves on a nonlinear dynamical system, and try to see if there is indeed sort of a sort of a lower, a decrease in dimensionality by the synchronization of all the firing of the neurons. It's very frustrating for neurophysiologists because there's no understanding of why those techniques seem to work. So for instance, one problem would be, can we actually make a statement by looking at the EEG recording and describe, you know, maybe the some form of decrease in dimensionality that is not just one number, but really a change in shape of this data set. Am I making sense here?
Okay. Could you clarify exactly the size of the space that you're looking at?
Okay,
for
so
those of us who haven't.
Thank you for asking that. So typically,
100,000 states, discrete states.
So here, for instance, we have 100,000 time samples. So we're recording typically between 100 to 1,000 hertz, so 100 to 1,000 samples per second. And we have about typically from 60 to 100 electrodes. Okay, so at each instant, I have a vector of size 100, roughly speaking. Okay. And I'm interested in studying the evolution of that vector as a function of time.
So there are 60 electrodes on the scalp, is what you're saying?
Yeah, from 60 to 100, yeah. Standard. Okay. So, of course, we need to make some assumptions about the problem. And so the assumption that we're going to make is that even though there are very large number, for instance, in the case of neuroimaging, if we start counting the neurons that contribute to the signal, it's unbelievably large. So there appears to be a very large number of degrees of freedom. However, at the scale at which we make the measurement, there actually is a loss of averaging that starts to work. And so in reality, the signal that we're looking at has much lower dimensionality. So what we're interested in may be able to recover a parametrization of the signal of interest, even though the ambient space may be high dimension. Okay, so just to set the notations right, this is the data set, this is our prototype data set. So we're going to collect, so here the index could be time, for instance, or it could be a voxel position inside an MRI data set. So this is one vector, one sample, another sample, so I have capital N samples of the vector of interest at high size, capital T. Okay, so capital T can be, for instance, if I'm looking at the channel problem with EEG recording, about 100. If I'm looking at an fMRI experiment, it's again about 100. So we start in this dimension, and
what
we can have
the T and N have to do with X.
I'm sorry.
So you got T Cartesian product N, and then you have X.
Cartesian product. No, this is just this is a T by N matrix.
What's that got to do with X?
So these are vectors. These are T rows by one column, T rows by one column.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
So okay. So we start in RT, okay, and we typically would like to construct a map that will bring us to a much lower dimensionality K, RK here. And of course the map should be of interest in the sense that when signals are similar, so when data samples in this big matrix are similar, in the ambient space they should be well preserved through the representation. So we would like to reduce the distortion as much as possible. So we're going to think about our data set as a graph. And so we're going to connect now, hopefully with Ilya's talk yesterday, for instance, where what we're going to do is we're going to take each sample here, xi, that is in R capital T, and we're going to consider that this sample will be a vertex of the graph. And we're going to build connections. If I have a picture. So here's the idea. So here's one sample, that's a signal. So for instance, T here is time, but it could be any other coordinate. So these are the original coordinates of my xi. And so we're going to build connections between the samples, vector here, xi, if the samples are close to one another. So for instance, we can use, in the simplest choice could be, for instance, to use the Euclidean distance between the two vector, xi and xj, okay? And then we're going to build the graph according to the k-nearest neighbor. So we look around and we see which are the vectors that are closest to us, and then we start building edges. And we're going to put some weight on the edges. And the weight, for instance, here appear as a sort of a Gaussian kernel with a scale parameters that is actually quite important features. So in summary, we've replaced the data set by a graph. And the idea of this graph is that if we look around each point, the closest neighbors should be the data points that probably are not necessarily acquired at the same or neighboring instant, but are very similar in the ambient space. So far, so good?
Yes, why is surface curve then? Because if it's a graph, there is no matrix.
That's right. I'll come back to that at the end. That's right. So,
but think of it as lying in some high-dimensional Euclidean space.
For instance.
And then the data set could look as if it were on that.
Well, the original points were in Euclidean space.
Yes.
Already.
Yeah. So to jump ahead of the slide, the point is, so for instance here, you think about the data are actually not being shattered all over R3, okay? They actually have some structure, and what you would like to be able to do is to recover, for instance, the shape or a nice parametrization of that sheet here, okay? Any question? So the tiling is just for you to be able to figure out the curvature of the
scale. Is this just imaging or from a real data
that one year? No, this is just sort of visual aid.
But buckle your seatbelt, we'll see one later.
That's right.
So
this is a rather lousy picture that I stole from the New York Times, but basically what I'm saying here is that the graph need not be in Euclidean space. We actually can build graph. This is a graph of document, okay? And there will be a workshop, a whole program actually next fall talking about exactly this thing, how to use this type of technique to search documents. And so what we're going to do then is we're going to build a random walk on the graph. And so we're going to have a transition, probably a transition that is going to depend on the weight. And then we can look at, for instance, the degree, and then define this probability transition, and then we have the stationary distribution. And this is just Markov chain machinery. Okay, so now we have the graph, and somehow we would like to recover the structure of the data set. So what we're going to do is we're going to define a good distance, okay, a meaningful distance on this graph. And bear in mind that often, data will appear similar, but they are really sort of accidentally similar in the sense that the noise, the variability in the data may create some random sort of small L2 norm. And so what we would like to do is to build a robust a measure of similarity that's going to be insensitive to sort of variation. So the idea is to look at the commute time. So if I look at this random walk, I can consider starting at node I and see how much time it takes me to get to node J and compute the expected hitting time. So it's the minimum amount of time that I need to go from I to J, and I compute the expectation of that. So this is asymmetric, so I can take a symmetric version. So it's basically the amount of time that it takes me to go from I to J and back. So the connection is defined by the graph, okay? And the probability of hopping is defined by the weight. Does that make sense?
Probability is defined by the weight. Yeah.
That's right.
Time scale is,
yeah, and time scale is So in fact, time is a virtual time, okay? But basically, if you think about it this way, what I'm interested in is sort of trying to find a nice coherent structure here, okay? Okay, so it does define a distance, okay? So it's pretty easy to check. So in fact, it's a very valuable distance for those of you which live in big cities. So for instance, if you want to travel in Paris from one of the two big train stations to another, you'll notice there are many different paths. Okay? It's a huge distance to go from Gare du Nord to Gare de Lyon. But you'll do that in a really short amount of time. Okay? So the commute time is really measuring how many paths there exist to go from one place to another. So even though the subway often, you know, is blocked or someone, you know, commits suicide in the morning at 7 o'clock, you still be able to make it and catch your 2G. Yes?
There's another part of the graph that's that, you know, God knows it's very connected to 7 million other stations, and a random walk will take a longer time.
Yes, I'll get to that.
What you're doing here is greedy. Like, you have many paths from A to B, so it's fast to get from A to B. It's not by random.
So I think I'll answer your question in a second. Any comment? Okay, yes.
And also the distance you use is kind of sensitive with respect to the connectivity of the graph, right?
That's true.
So So the distance here is a distance, but it's not a very stable distance at this point.
So I'll address that point, yeah. So the construction of the graph is a critical point. That's exactly right, yeah. So we can first just compare this distance and sort of address this question, you know, how different is that commute time to the shortest distance on the graph? And so we have this double inequality here. So the lower bound is sort of trivial. The upper bound, we have a constant here, which is the sum of the weight divided by the weakest, the smallest weight. Okay, so that can be quite large. In fact, if you think about your worst commute time in LA, you can ask yourself, given a number of vertices, okay, what is the graph that will actually maximize the commute time. Okay. And so it turns out that this is a lollipop graph. So we have a click here with, you know, this is the a complete subgraph, and you have about a third of your vertices that are along this path. And so if you compute the commute time from I to j here, you actually end up something of the order of n cubed. Okay? And the reason is that you spend an awful lot of time here, and it takes a lot of time to actually reach there. Which addresses your point, right? And so this is actually completely consistent with our bounds in the sense that the distance here is the order of n, you know, if you go from any point in the clique to I here, and the constant is about the order n squared, okay? I'm actually happy with that. I'm happy with that because I think about this as being actually a cluster of signals, and this is probably an outlier. Okay, so if there's sort of a weak connection here, I'm very happy to sort of only look at those points as being people, the sort of samples that are close to one another, and this guy to be actually quite far away.
So this constraint problem, how many edges are you allowed to put in? As many as you want?
As many as you wish, that's right. So it's standard. Okay, so so now, so if I'm happy with commute time, I may be interested in finding a representation that allows me to measure commute time very fast. So the idea here is to look at this matrix, which is sort of a pseudo-inverse of the Laplacian on the graph, and to realize that I can measure commute time basically by reading the entries of that matrix. Okay, this is standard Markov chain machinery, and the idea of the proof is that the heating time will actually solve sort of a Laplace equation, and this being sort of the pseudo inverse of the Laplacian, you can write the heating time in this form. Okay, so it's particularly useful if we can diagonalize this matrix and write down the heating time and therefore the symmetric version of it in terms of the eigenfunction of either this matrix or that matrix. So what in practice what we do is we look at the transition matrix, we make it symmetric by correcting by the essentially this is the stationary distribution that is non-weighted here. And we look at the eigenfunction of this matrix, the symmetric matrix, and the eigenvalues are between minus 1 and 1, and we can write down the commute time by essentially summing over all the eigenfunction, and by replacing each node, each vertex here, by the value of that eigenfunction k at that node. And so the distance becomes, the commute time distance between I and j becomes the Euclidean distance between the two eigenfunctions. Does that make sense? So in a nutshell, what we do is we define, we start from the graph, we build this map by replacing each vertex, mapping each vertex to the value of the eigenfunction at that vertex. And now, through this map, the Euclidean distance becomes the commute time. So we can measure extremely rapidly the commute time between any two point ij on the graph, okay? By just reading the eigenfunction.
But you gotta compute the eigenfunction.
True. But there is IPAM and there is Minerva analysis to do that. So hopefully we can do that. So this is actually a very old idea, and it goes back to spectral geometry, and so I'd like to build a few connections here. So as I said, the eigenfunction the symmetric version of the transition matrix are also eigenfunction of the Laplacian. We just need to correct for the eigenvalue. Those eigenfunctions are actually good eigenfunctions in the sense that they're going to sort of minimize this distortion measured by this Rayleigh ratio here. And they have been used for some spectral clustering by Misha Belkin and Yogi. They are the same eigenfunction that Rafi Kaufman, Stéphane Lafon, and his group are using at EF, for instance. So in that, the commute time is really the diffusion distance. So it basically, it again is related to this idea of looking at the heat kernel on a manifold. So if you believe that, for instance, your data are sampled from some n-dimensional manifold, you may want, for instance, to build a map from the manifold to a set of coordinates that would describe the manifold. And so work in spectral geometry has shown that you can actually build this map essentially using exactly the eigenfunction of the Laplacian here. Okay? So there are lots of connections, and they're all related to this idea of diffusing heat on the manifold, diffusing heat on the graph.
What's the little n?
So here the little n is the ambient space where you have your manifold. Okay? So that's my capital T. True. What do you mean, I don't know that? Yes, I do know.
How do you know?
Oh, in real life?
Yeah.
No, I don't. That's true. That's a good point. This is work in spectral geometry. So you can, but so I'll address that actually in the second part of the talk. That's a good question. Thanks. So in fact, you can think about this embedding here by a sort of a composition of two things. You can start by taking points on your manifold here and putting a little heat a little heat kernel around that point, and so you map effectively the manifold into the space of L2 function on the manifold. And then you can find a good choice of bases for the space of function that are given by the eigenfunction of the Laplacian. So I think Peter will talk a little bit more about those connections here. So this is this may actually prove to be a lot more robust than what we're doing. So in summary, here's the algorithm, and I'll illustrate some examples and some data sets. So we start with our data set here. Each input is a vector of size capital T. We have n, capital N such vector. We're going to choose a number of nearest neighbors, and we're going to choose a scaling parameter to measure the weights or the size of the diffusion kernel that we're going to use on the graph. And we need to find a number of eigenfunctions, or sort of dimensionality of the underlying manifold, if we believe in the manifold hypothesis. And so then what we do is we construct a graph from the data set by picking at each time n sub n nearest neighbors to each point. We find the weight matrix and compute the transition probability on the graph, diagonalize this matrix, find the first capital K eigenfunction, and then replace the coordinates by the value of those eigenfunctions on the graph. So this is a totally nonlinear map. It's not a projection on some eigenfunction. It's really the evaluation of the eigenfunction at the point I, which is really x sub I. Okay? So while I was having breakfast, I was just running this analysis my favorite donut, noisy donut here. And so this is the new representation where we can see that we essentially we can parameterize this by two parameters. It really should be flat, but I added a lot of noise. Okay? So this is just points or sample on the surface of the torus here, and we just add noise, so we're, there is some jitter on the surface, and we obtain this parametrization.
So, so, the, point,
right,
so the point is that on the right you, you have a new parameterization of the donut
right,
by a few eigenfunctions. So x on the left-hand side goes to phi one or phi two of x.
That's right. So here, this is the this is the input data set. It turns out that the points are sampled on the surface of the donut, okay? But the algorithm does not know that. And so what we get is a new parametrization. So each dot here is a dot on the, in the initial space.
Three eigenfunctions, don't you think? How many eigenfunctions?
I'm using the first three. The first one is trivial and of no interest. So in reality, I really need two. That's a very good idea, Stan, and we'll get back to that. Yeah. So there is, but it does not necessarily give you a parametrization.
Well, it gives you a nice picture.
It does give you a nice picture. That's right. But when I'm struggling with large fMRI data set, the picture is may not be what I need a little more. But the heat equation, yeah, plays a big role. Yeah, so essentially, forget the torus, think about the circle. Okay. So we'll make it even simpler. So the eigenfunction in the circle will simply be so cosine and sine, and then they're going to give you the parametrization of your circle.
Well, they're cosine n theta and sine n theta.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the first one that I would be interested in. Yes. And as Peter mentions, as you go for higher eigenfunction, you will just that's right.
Yeah.
Question. Yes.
So, but the topology is not right, right? The whole thing is a double map.
So here's what happens. If you remove the noise, you know, you basically get a ring. Okay. So in fact, if you collapse to a circle, you get a circle. So essentially, as you travel along this direction, you're moving in this direction across the cross section of the donut.
So you can view it as a projection directly to the x-y plane?
You can look at it, that's right. This point is actually very nearby this one. Okay. So this is interval 0 to pi, basically parameterizing this thing. Does that make sense? So the distance, the distance, that's right, that's a good point. Why is that?
He suggested it was bubbling over.
It's just ridiculous enough if you went to a 6, you'd get the whole
back part. Right, I should be able to close it back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here's an easier example.
It's a good point.
Take the 2 sphere, take S2. The first three non-trivial eigenvectors are x, y, z, right? That happens to be the original embedding, okay? But if you took a nice topological sphere, you'll discover that there's robustness, and you will get mapped by the first three eigenfunctions to something that's recognizably a sphere, even though you may start out in a very high dimensional space. Sorry.
That's okay. So, yeah, it's a good point. You need to close this thing. Okay, so I will give more example in the second talk, but let me just give you a sort of an appetizer for what I'll be talking about in the next talk. So here the problem is that we have some it's a very concrete problem. This is the EEG problem where we would like to classify some reporting of electrodes that are acquired on the scalp. And we really want to be able to distinguish between normal recording baseline and ictal or seizure state. And so the question is, can we find a good representation that has low dimensions so we can do good classification? So the data set comes as this. We have 55 channels, so we have 55 leads where we're recording on the surface here. And we have three type of time series: baseline, so this is completely normal; preictal, this is the sort of the time where the seizure is going to occur very soon; ictal, this is the seizure state. Okay, and so we're working with, so we're looking at the data set as a vector in R to the 55. So we're looking at the state of the electrodes as the brain varies as a function of time. Again, this is just a pictorial idealization of this concept. I'm looking at electrodes at time T0, Ti, Tj, and I would like to be able to see if I can observe a reduction, for instance, in dimensionality, or a changes in the state of the brain as I go from normal to a seizure state.
So, time is continuous in reality. You don't have discrete
data sets, you just
continuous
trace.
There's
nothing
like
continuous.
Like sampling theorem, you don't get the signals.
Everything is discrete.
How often do they record?
Oh, you record extremely fast. You record 1,000 samples per second, which is obscenely higher than anything you can measure. So typically, you have to the best filter actually to make sense. So, in fact, that's a good question, because what happens is, if you naively just measure the distance between the recording, you really are going only to talk about the points that are similar in time, okay? So you have to be a little creative to be able to hop to maybe one point at the beginning of the recording, and so maybe a state that is much, much later in the recording. So there are some issues about why temporal correlation actually is bad to be able to sort of find the a good clustering of the states.
Change signals.
Yes?
I should precision. For your example, if I've understood that you have points in the space 55,
yeah,
and you find for the curve, which would
parameterize
the states,
yes,
as a function of time.
Okay. Yes, that's exactly right. So here's what we obtain, knowing the label. So what we have is we have some training samples. So each little circle has been colored according to the state of the brain at that time. Okay. So another way to think about it is that as we hop from one circle to another, we're moving in time. Okay. But there is no causality. I mean, neighboring circle need not be neighbored in time. Okay. They're just similar in their state. So what is really interesting is that knowing the label, we can actually see that the ictal state in red, when I projected on, when I use the first non-trivial eigenfunction, appears to have a much lower dimensionality, whereas the normal state spans, a sort of a more complex structure. And in fact, what is even more interesting is that the preictal, so the state that transitions from normal to ictal, is sitting right in between these two structures. Okay. The post-ictal state, so when the patient recovers from the seizure, is spread across all over these two states. Okay. So this is, when we show that to a neurophysiologist that we're working with in Colorado, he was actually quite interested, because the way people predict or the appearance of seizure is really by measuring something like correlation dimension or Lyapunov exponent and make a statement about a decrease in dimensionality. But this is a real picture trying to explain this. Okay, so this is hopefully more insightful to neurophysiologists. There's a different view here. Yes. So these are the value of the eigenfunction.
Okay.
So these are the new coordinate to represent. So essentially, if you wanna think about it this way, what we've done is we've taken the 55 channels that describe the state, the brain state at any given time, okay? And we've thrown that away, and we replaced those 55 values by, in this case, 3, so that you can look at it, but typically we need about 10, okay, to actually understand the structure of the data set.
Now,
did
the sign
work
today?
Is the picture stable from the number of eigenfunctions you use?
Yes, well, so what do you mean the picture is stable?
Here's a computer on you.
Yes.
Are you getting the picture? Because it was not stable in the donut example.
So that's true. So the choice of eigenfunctions for the picture matters a great deal. For the we have a different benchmark. We have a different way to measure the success of our representation. And I'll get back to that in a second, which is the classification. So, which is really, let's assume we understand the geometry. Now, here comes a new sample. Can I, using this representation, can I classify it between, you know, normal and abnormal? That's the way we measure success. And the number of eigenfunctions matters, but it doesn't matter a great deal. After a certain, if we have enough, then we're actually doing very well.
Well, how about, for example, starting with k eigenfunctions, characterizing the data, taking the same data, looking at k plus 1 eigenfunctions, and projecting that, the first k dimensions, and comparing the two things. I don't think that's exactly the same thing because of the non-linearities.
So that's right. So it's a non-linear map.
So how would that work?
We haven't tried that. So you would like to start with low dimension and then rewrite this at sort of a higher dimension?
So the other way around, slightly.
Right. We can actually do that.
That would be an intrinsic test of the method. Maybe I should have said 2k to k.
That's right. That's a very nice idea. And I think sometimes we do things similar to actually remove some of the noise. To find, we start with a large number of eigenfunction, and then we rerun the heat kernel on that, rebuild the graph, and sort of lower. This is a very stable mechanism, actually. This works.
Stable what?
The procedure is very stable. Because what we do is we start with a large number of eigenfunction, get a representation, of course, that we cannot look at, but then re-parametrize this using exactly the same idea. And that allows us to remove a lot of the noise.
I have some basic compute. To be able to color these dots, you have to have an independent knowledge that state corresponds to this, and this corresponds to
that's exactly right.
So that's actually some observation, medical observation or something.
That's exactly right.
Actual person lies there.
Yes.
Know, right?
Yes.
Now, you're saying, okay, suppose I now have another data set. Paid on a real person in a real situation. So why don't you consider that person had a seizure at that moment or didn't have a seizure? I'm confused. So what's the
I don't understand your question.
Well, you don't know a priori the other person has a seizure that they're going to have a seizure.
True.
So how did they know this pre whatever thing?
Okay.
Let me
answer your question. So the state of the art in this business. This is actually quite shocking. If you go in a hospital in a neurology department, it's visual inspection. I mean, literally, we're in the 21st century. People are recording this massive amounts of data, digitized data. And at the end of the day, neurologists look at that, say, here's a seizure. Oh, okay, it started, and then go back on the trace in the paper and say, this is where it started. So the label are coming from the expert, from the neurologist. Okay, so does that answer your question?
So they're trained simply by looking at the encephalograph to see.
Yes.
How many dimensions do you normally have in practice? In this? How many are sufficient? For example, this picture seems to suggest that you can only measure a scalar.
So let me just go to the next slide, so hopefully most of the questions will be answered. Yes.
Yes. Dimensionality of the
factors.
Yes.
Time embedding story is completely consistent. So we've actually done this experiment, and so we get similar results. So what they're doing is they build this manifold basically by looking at a time embedding and measure things like correlation dimension. And we do see, for instance, that here the correlation dimension is much lower than there.
Okay.
But this is a completely different story.
But
okay.
If you remind me, I'll address this in my lecture on Friday.
Okay, so
I have to decide what Kenny does.
I'm sorry?
I have to decide how many neighbors to take to build the graph.
Okay, I'll get back to that at the end of the talk. So this is the way we actually validate the parametrization. What we do is we do cross-validation. So we train the classifier. So we use 10 eigenfunction to summarize our 55-dimensional data set. And what we do is we, based on the new representation, here only showing 3, but really work with 10, we try to find the structure. We do classification, okay? Knowing the label, we try to find what are the right boundaries between abnormal and normal, okay? We use the kernel-rich regression. This is irrelevant here. Basically, in a nutshell, if we try to just do the classification, for instance, and figure out not knowing where the data, so to validate, we take data that have been observed and for which we know the label. So for instance, we would like, here comes a new baseline data. We know it's a nice baseline data, but it's not labeled, so we just try to classify it using the 55 dimension, and just as a success rate that we have. This is abnormal, and this is a total success rate. And clearly, using this idea of doing a random walk on the graph, we get much higher classification. So we're able to do just as well as the neurologist in the child. So that's basically the conclusion. Okay. So this is, again, classifying data after learning the structure of the different states, but this is without knowing. And you see that red is classified as these are abnormal, and they're really finding the ictal state here with reduced dimensionality, and there's nice interface between the two states. Okay, so computations. We really are hurt by this curse of dimensionality. We have to find, you know, a way to find neighbors in, you know, 50, 100 dimensions. This is something that is really hurting us in terms of the speed of the algorithm. We are working with fairly large samples, so we typically have about 100 to a million thousand sample, and so we have this matrix now, which is 10 to the 5 by 10 to the 5. It doesn't work in math, so we need to be a little creative. We need to really find better eigensolver, much faster. These are real interesting questions. For instance, this algorithm requires that you compute for any new incoming data, re-estimate the eigenfunction to find the parametrization, okay? Can we do that? Can we update? Is there a quick and nice way to update the eigenfunctions? This is answering a question that was asked about how do we choose the number of nearest neighbors and how do we choose the width of the heat kernel on the graph? Both parameters have a huge influence on the eigenfunction.
So can I make a comment here? So slide is exactly parallel to the problem of the stability of the Google PageRank algorithm. So you notice that if you type in the same keywords 24 hours apart, you'll get different results. That's because the eigenvectors change. There's a lack of stability in the eigenvectors. And this is one of the problems that appears here.
Right. So, in a sense, the number of nearest neighbors is critical because it's going to give the geometry of the data set that for which we're going to, you know, run the heat kernel on. And then the really critical question is there a nice way to estimate the dimensionality, so the number of eigenfunctions that we need to parameterize the data set? I'll address that in the second talk. Really, this dimension is sort of, it could actually vary along the data set as we were looking at this seizure data set.
But there wasn't a heat kernel.
I did such a terrible job, did I? Yes, there is a heat kernel. The idea is that you run the heat kernel in your 55-dimensional space. and you look at, essentially you look at the eigenfunction of the Laplacian that you can use to reconstruct the integral. But it's really looking at the diffusion of the integral. That's exactly right. So these are the reference. So I'll stop here. Thank you very much for your attention.